couch of potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films The High Note, The Vast of Night, Space Force, and Central Park, plus a look back at the return of the Pink Panther from the vault. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring John Carpenter's Escape from L.A. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Today's news, I'm not going to talk about theaters reopening, whether they will, and what's going to happen, and what are the likelihoods of this happening or that happening, because I've talked about that for the last couple weeks. I'm kind of tired of it. But there is something in the pandemic news that's percolating out there that people are starting to question, and I think it's worth mentioning it and addressing it, and that is, when will production start up again? Because when the lockdown happened in March, it shut everything down. And I got a friend who works in a writer's room. And I remember talking to him, it was either late March or early April. And he's like, oh yeah, no, pretty much people have written off the summer. That was his words that he used. And he said that the writing rooms are still working. There's a lot of places that are still writing. Because you can do that on a virtual level, you know, Zoom calls and email stuff back and forth. But once the script's done, it doesn't have anywhere to go. So I think what's happening now, especially in television, not so much in movies. First of all, I'll address the difference. The movies have time to ramp back up into production because they've delayed so many of the big ones. The shelves aren't empty at the studios. They've still got Wonder Woman and No Time to Die and Fast and Furious and the Gru movie and all these other films that are slated as early as July. But throughout the rest of the year, there's still stuff coming. So the big releases are still, you still have this backlog of those that can go in the theaters, and they can spread those out as they need while they're ramping up production on other films. TV is a totally different monster. TV works with a pipeline. TV works with getting stuff written, getting stuff produced, getting stuff edited. And then, of course, you got to go through the whole production of getting the show sold and advertised. They didn't have upfronts this year because there's nothing to have upfronts with. Usually they would have been shooting pilots in the spring, but they're not because they're still shut down. It's very, very difficult to keep everybody safe. Film production sets are known for being crowded, and they can have a lot of people together. It's very hard to socially distance, even if you have a set. Actors can't put PPE on. I mean, I think there might be a way that at a certain point, some shows like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I can see Brooklyn Nine-Nine go back into production with everybody in full PPE because it takes place in Brooklyn, and they treat it like that's what the characters are doing. And so you just put them in the, you know, the protective gear, and then they can act. That's going to make it an awkward show, but you can work around that. You know, or medical show can do that as well. You know, you can have productions of Grey's Anatomy go on with that. I don't know if that's something they're considering, but otherwise, you know, you can't have a, you know, episode of This Is Us with everybody in PPE. You got to have the cameras right there in front of the people. And if you have a sitcom, you got to have the live studio audience. So you can't produce it that way. So there's a lot of these hurdles of social distancing and protection that they don't have. Plus, you also got to realize a TV show isn't just one business. It's not like opening up a salon or reopening up your little shop on the corner or even reopening the dining room of a restaurant. A TV show is multiple ends of it. You've got the production office, and you've got all those challenges of an office. You've got set, and that's all the challenges of the set. You've got editing, you've got sales, you've got development. It's its own company. Every TV show is that. Now, there are some instances of them trying to bring production back. Michael Bay is apparently going to be producing it sounds like it's going to be almost found footage, and I can see him going that way because they mentioned some found footage movies in the piece talking about this. And so that's going to cut down on the crew. Blumhouse is talking about doing a very small like $5 million production on set and using hotels nearby. But these are very specific cases. The biggest thing holding these back, though, is the insurance, production insurance. Production insurance is something that all productions have, and it insures against things happening. It insures against pandemics or earthquakes or anything that would shut production down and cost money, it insures for. Probably the best known, easiest to understand example is when they were shooting that Fast and Furious 7, and Paul Walker died in the middle of it. It had nothing to do with him on set. He just died. And they had to pause production and rewrite the movie and then reshoot a bunch of stuff. It cost a lot of money, and that's covered by production insurance. But right now, already, production insurance is paying through the nose for all the productions that got shut down in the middle, and they're covering the overages. No one's going to give you insurance to start a production in the middle of a pandemic. It's like no one's going to sell you cheap fire insurance if there's an arsonist running around your neighborhood. So these are the things that they're running into. I think what's going to happen is TV shows are going to have to adjust. I think you're going to have certain places that you can do production, but you're not going to go into full-on production probably for another year. And so TV's going to have to adjust. They're going to have to adjust for broadcast television. They might be bringing in more news and variety acts. This is going to affect the industry the way the commercial actor strike in 2000 affected the industry. That gave us reality TV. People forget, at the time, there were some reality TV shows like American Idol and Survivor. But it was when you had the commercial actor strike that suddenly they ramped up reality TV to 11 and started cranking out these shows because you didn't have to get your on-screen people from the union. So I think this is going to change the face of television. I don't quite know what it's going to be yet, but you know, it's still a little bit of time before productions resume. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Infamous, which is available on VOD on January 12th.
The videos captured during the robberies and uploaded to social media are the work of Ariel Summers and Dean Taylor.
Open it safe! Let's go!
The couple, followed by millions of people on social media, have been called a modern day.
Hi. My name is Ariel. And for as long as I can remember, I knew I was going to be famous.
Oh gosh, you know, can we retire the concept of the new Bonnie and Clyde? I am so tired of those movies. There's no uniqueness to them. Probably the closest thing you got to a unique storytelling was Natural Born Killers. Like 20 some years ago. But even then, that one, that was just sort of reveling in violence. I didn't quite enjoy that movie. Infamous just looks like Bella Thorne post directing a porno movie for Pornhub, trying to look sexy all the time in front of the camera and not actually acting in it. I don't know. This movie looks like it's a throwaway. The next one I want to hit really quickly is The Old Guard, which will be debuting on Netflix on July 10th.
So you good guys or bad guys?
Depends on the century.
So we really never die.
Throughout history, we've protected this world, fighting in the shadows. It's nearly impossible to disappear in the world we live in today.
These are extraordinary individuals. They are extremely resistant to capture.
They're going to lock us up and weaponize us. But they've never faced an army like ours.
This one looks decent. I mean, it's your mercenary kind of movie, but with immortals. And Charlize Theron has shown that she can throw down as an action star with like Atomic Blonde and Mad Max Fury Road. So I think she's absolutely got the chops to do this. I just hope that the story's compelling and it's not just a bunch of explosions. I get no sense of real story to this. It just looks like it's doubling down on the action, which worked for something like Extraction, the Chris Hemsworth movie. I don't know if it's going to work for this because there looks like there's some high concept stuff that they can mine. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a movie like Bloodshot, that Vin Diesel movie that came out and was shifted to VOD during the pandemic. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The High Note and Central Park. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with High Note. A woman working as an assistant to an aging singer tries to start her own career as a music producer.
If you told 12-year-old me that one day I'd be working for Grace Davis, she's an icon.
This woman doesn't even know your last name.
She does, sometimes.
My baby
stop, 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 stop. I'm not going to tell you guys you're great if you're not great. Do it again.
Baby,
girls still give me goosebumps.
Well, Grace, have you thought any more about the Vegas residency?
Actually, I think it's time I record a new album.
I mean, that's one plan.
This is one of those films that was going to go and have a regular theatrical release. In fact, I believe I remember seeing it advertised in the theaters back in like March or something like that. Because when I got the opportunity to view this as a screener so I could talk about it this weekend, I watched the trailer and I'm like, God, this looks familiar. And I realized I'd seen it a couple weeks or several weeks before in front of another movie. I don't remember what movie it was, but this was one that was bona fide going to come to theaters. And they said, okay, we're just going to pivot to VOD. Now, this movie I struggle with. And the biggest reason is that there's nothing in this movie that I find even remotely interesting. I didn't care about the characters. I didn't care about the story. I'm not a big fan of how the music industry works because I find it sort of sleazy and smarmy. And I just don't, I feel like I need to take a shower after watching anything that goes behind the scenes. For the matter, I feel the same way about watching a movie about how Hollywood works. I'm more interested in how a movie works behind the scenes because I'm a movie guy. I mean, I like music as much as the next guy, but I'm not like, you know, there are people that are music guys, and I'm not a music guy. I'm not a sports guy. I'm a movie guy. I love that kind of stuff. So the getting behind the scenes of this, it always seems somewhat depressing. The movie itself, it feels like A Star Is Born without the alcoholism and the love story. Although there is a love story in this, but it's not the self-destructive love story you had with A Star Is Born. But I felt very much the same way about The Star Is Born when that came out, what was it, last year or the year before? And watching it and going, it's a well-made movie, but I just have no interest in it. I hated A Star Is Born because I didn't find it interesting. And that's the way I feel here. But I mean, the elements are all there. I mean, Dakota Johnson, I actually am a big fan of Dakota Johnson. I think she has charisma and charm, and she looks just a sweet and adorable on screen. I think she works super well. I'm a big fan. I like what she does, and I always have. And then, I mean, she was the only thing that really made those 50 Shades of Grey movies any good, and it wasn't just because she was naked, although that didn't hurt. No, I'm kidding. I think Dakota Johnson's a really, you know, a good actor. And I think she has that charisma. She has that it factor that helps you connect to her on screen. Tracy Ellis Ross, I think she's a good actor too. I don't watch Black-ish. I'm not a big fan of hers, but I recognize that she's got good screen chemistry and she works. And the production's very well done. I mean, it looks good. It's well put together. Ice Cube's in it as the manager, and he does a good job. He's appropriately fit into the role as this sort of sleazy manager that's kind of just looking out for himself more than anybody else. And so that all works well in the movie. I think that, and then the music is very well produced, but it's not at all any music that I care about. It's not my cup of tea. It's seriously, when I watch these scenes and they'd have the music going, I would just zone out because I'm not a fan of that music. But I recognize it's all done well, even though I have zero interest in it. So it's weird coming to a movie like this because I kind of have to confess I didn't like anything about it, but I didn't like anything about it strictly because of taste. I know I don't like these kind of movies. I know I have no interest. I'm so tired of seeing the story of the person who's working with their synthesizer, making their own cuts and music and everything. That just stuff just bores me. And I didn't like the music. So there's nothing about it that interests me, but it's a well-done movie. And if you like anything about it, you're probably going to like it. I still have to say it sucks. But don't take my word for it, I guess.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next, well, it's not a movie, it's a series. And that is Central Park. This series from the creator of Bob's Burgers follows the caretaker family of Central Park trying to keep things working.
I hate that park. It's just a patch of dirt and weeds. And we're gonna buy it. We're gonna do the biggest real estate deal in the history of the world.
Someone needs to protect the park.
It's impossible.
Nothing's impossible.
Did your voice just get really weird?
Central Park!
How many times did you text him?
What would you say is normal?
Twice?
Oh, no.
Where else can your son and daughter splash in dirty hot dog water?
Are we dancing? Yeah, we're dancing.
Is that dancing?
I'm a huge fan of Bob's Burgers. I like the look of the show, and I like the edge of the show. What one of the things that's nice about Bob's Burgers is it's grown-up cartoons. I mean, it's not a kid's show, but it's sort of almost like a PG-13 version of the Flintstones. It's not like the Seth MacFarlane block. The Seth MacFarlane block, those are deeply at times offensive and button pushy and not something you'd want a kid watching. A kid watching Bob's Burgers doesn't bother me. I think that it might have some inappropriate jokes in there, but no more than just your average Marvel movie would. You know, so they don't double down on just being obnoxious and gross. And you know, it's like I talked about Solar Opposites a couple weeks ago, and I like Solar Opposites, but Solar Opposites, done by the people who did Rick and Morty, it's clearly pushing the envelope of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, all the stuff that can offend people. And it has, you know, swearing and that sort of thing all throughout. This one, and it's not trying to be a kid's movie, but it's a little more appropriate for, you know, family watching. And it's not just a comedy, but it's a musical. So you got Josh Gad as this narrator, and he goes around singing, and he's completely appropriate in this. And it's also not just a love letter to Central Park. It recognizes that you got bums urinating in the bushes, and you got dirty hot dog water on the street, and there are some weird people in there. But there's also some wonderful things about Central Park. And I think it really strikes a balance as to what works about Central Park. Central Park is beautiful, and it's vast, and it's huge. It also addresses something I've always said. I'm like, it's a good thing they carved out Central Park when they did, because I think there've probably been real estate developers just chomping at the bit for decades wanting to develop it. It is a massive swath of real estate in the middle of Manhattan. I don't even know what the value of it would be, but the whole bad guy of the story is this old woman played by Stanley Tucci, who's a great choice for it, by the way. I love Tucci. And he does this great job as this evil woman. She's essentially a Scooby-Doo villain wanting to get rid of the park itself so she can develop it. Tucci does a great job, you know, playing her up and chewing the scenery. And the animation works. The animation is, like I said, it's in the style of Bob's Burgers, so it has a look. And occasionally some of the voices show up, like I think H. John Benjamin, who plays Bob, and also Sterling Archer in Archer. He shows up as like the mayor or something like that, and you recognize the voice. The musical side of it, I think, is the danger, because I don't want it to turn into Glee. Glee started out as having stories and songs that were relevant to the show, but then it just turned into a jukebox musical where they just had song breaks, because it's very hard to work in plot-driven songs. And Glee abandoned that very early. I hope that Central Park doesn't, or it abandons the music altogether. It could do either of those. But overall, it's a cute show. It's on Apple TV Plus. It's worth checking out. I gotta say, it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Vast of Night and Space Force. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. We're going to talk about The Vast of Night. This is one that had a pretty successful independent festival run. Did well at Slam Dance and Fantastic Fest. And I believe it was going to get a theatrical release, although probably was not going to be a big wide one. It was going to be a limited release. But it pivoted to streaming, and it's now available on Amazon Prime. So if you've got a subscription to Amazon Prime, you can watch it with no extra charge. In The Vast of Night, two teenagers in a small New Mexico town in the 1950s discover a mysterious noise coming from space.
718 here at WOTW. We got a sound we'd like to play that seems to be bouncing around the valley tonight.
Yes, I have a
They've come here before. They've liked this place. They always have.
What's going on? There's something in the sky.
This has a framing device similar to the Twilight Zone. It starts out with a 1950s TV in a 1950s suburban home, and it's watching, essentially, it's the Twilight Zone, but it's, you know, a knockoff of it. It's not the Twilight Zone itself. It's called, I forget what it's called, the Paradox Circuit or something like that. And it introduces basically the story, and then we kind of go into it. So the framing device is like, this is a single Twilight Zone episode, but it's an hour and a half movie. And the story takes place in the small town of Cayuga, New Mexico, which I believe is a real town, near Alamogordo. And that's important because, you know, back, if you look at the 50s with the UFO sightings and any sort of bizarre elements like that, there's always something traceable to, you know, somewhere in New Mexico. I mean, Roswell's in New Mexico. Corona was near, that was actually the closest town. Roswell was the Air Force base where they sent the Air Force out, the Army Air Force, to investigate. But there's a lot of test piloting done there. There's a lot of research done there. And there's a ton of UFO history to New Mexico, in particular near Alamogordo. And that's comes up throughout the movie. The film plays with one shots a lot. Like, the whole story follows these two teenagers. One works for the local radio station and the other works as a switchboard operator. And it's one of these small towns. And you had these a lot in the '50s. You don't have them as much anymore, but in the '50s and sixties, I think even in the '70s, these small towns that would essentially shut down when there was a high school sporting event. Everyone would go to the high school basketball game. I mean, you have that kind of stuff with high school football now in West Texas and places that really get into their local football. But you don't get that as much anymore. But that was like a big thing back in the '50s, and it would shut down. All the stores would shut down. All the houses would be empty and everyone would be at the game. And it's just these two teenagers that have these respective jobs that they have. The one guy's doing the news and spinning records, and the other girl is plugging the operator plug-and-play thing with the switchboard. And we follow them first going through the basketball court in the school and them getting prepared to do their things, and then they hear this stuff on the air, and it cuts through the radio, and the girl at the switchboard, she calls the guy at the radio, and they start investigating it. And the movie itself is very simple. I mean, they use a lot of these one shots. It's not a high sci-fi, special effects type movie. It's mostly, you know, this girl named Faye on the switchboard and this kid named Everett on the radio trying to come up with this. And of course, you know, they're talking to callers and that sort of thing. And the cast, it's most people you probably won't recognize. Sierra McCormick plays Faye. And Jake Horowitz plays Everett. They're not big names, but they've done some stuff. But they're both really good. They carry the movie to the point that, I mean, they are compelling to watch. They kind of have these, they're both kind of these archetypal 50s characters. I mean, she's kind of a bit of a science geek from school, but you know, she's got the saddle shoes and the 50s skirts, and he's got the greased hair and the thick rimmed glasses. But you know what? This thing really works. I it kept my interest. It had me going through the whole thing. The payoff, it has a payoff. Maybe it's not as strong as it could be, but overall, this movie kept my interest and I had a blast watching it. This is one of those pandemic gems I have found over the last couple weeks where there's movies that I may have not seen. I may have not had a chance to see or just didn't hit my radar, but because I'm watching some more alternative stuff for coverage, this came across my desk and I'm glad I watched it. It's a great little sci-fi Twilight Zone type movie and absolutely should check it out. It's on Amazon Prime right now. The Vast of Night totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with Space Force. This is a Netflix series. Steve Carell headlines this new workplace comedy about the establishment of a space force and the attempt to legitimize it in the eyes of the other branches of the military.
Our nation's internet runs through our vulnerable space satellites. POTUS wants complete space dominance. To that end, the president is creating a new branch. Space Force, which Mark will run.
What?
This is a great adventure.
There will be setbacks, but greatness was never won without sacrifice.
How much was that prototype?
4 million?
Middle schools. Cost as much as 4 new middle schools.
This is created by both Steve Carell and Greg Daniels, and Greg Daniels is best known for doing The Office. So obviously they work together quite a lot, and the two of them have put this together. Now, it's not like The Office in the sense it's not a mockumentary. It's not like you got a camera crew following them around. It's a basic single camera show. It looks really good. I mean, it has some very high production value. It has some interesting special effects. Obviously, they're going into space. It's got some great stars in it, too. Not just Steve Carell. And you've got the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You got like Jane Lynch and you've got Patrick Warburton. You've got some big names in there. But then you also have John Malkovich as Steve Carell's foil. Steve Carell's the military guy who's really most about just, you know, what does the military do? I mean, the military's there to attack and defend. That's what you need the military for. They're for national defense. You have John Malkovich playing his foil, which is the science guy, because if you're going to be going into space, you want to have somebody know something about science. And he's more like the old hippie, and he's much more about the softer side and the more scientific side. And of course, they're clashing all the time, but Carell and Malkovich have a great chemistry here. Now, it seems like they have more characters than they need right now. And I think that's because, you know, something like The Office had a whole lot of characters, but you really only had 3 or 4 as the main. This one is a little more complex in the inner workings of the characters. Like, Carell has a daughter, and she's going through her problems because she's kind of a rebel, and his wife, played by Lisa Kudrow, is in prison. So they're dealing with that as a side story, which makes it interesting, but it hasn't quite gelled. And there's about 10 episodes on Netflix now, and they're funny, but it hasn't quite figured out what it needs to be. You know, if you watch that first season of The Office, they're really kind of aping the British show. And it's not until they get well into the second season that they realize they need to make it, they're going to Americanize it a little more. They're going to make it a little more broad and a little more slapsticky. We've not reached the level of Kevin with a giant pot of chili spilling it all over the office yet. Kind of the premise is Steve Carell plays a well-known general who's good at his job, but he's a little bit simple. He's very black and white and cut and dry, kind of like a Michael Scott character if Michael Scott had gone through the military. But of course, with going into space, there's a little more nuance, and you can't just throw rockets at something to make it work in space, but it's showing his determination overcomes his lack of ability to recognize science, which may not be the right message that it should be giving. I think they still have to figure out what all the characters are doing. So it's entertaining to a degree, but it's not great. But I think a second season with some tweaks will actually be pretty good. But I'm still going to say Space Force kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to have a retro review of The Return of the Pink Panther and talk about the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Escape from L.A. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the show with a retro review. I like to throw these things now and then in because, you know, there's still a lot of people staying home. And I think we're going to have a lot of people staying home more often than normal. There's a lot of summertime events that have been canceled. I mean, in my hometown, you know, all the 4th of July stuff, you have the parade, the fireworks. That's been canceled. You know, pools have been canceled for various reasons. And you can sit there and complain all you want, post on social media about that. But that's just the way things are. So I still think there's going to be a lot of people staying home more often than not. There's still people looking for stuff to watch. And look, I think it's one thing to say I've got Hulu, I've got Netflix, I've got Amazon Prime. At a certain point, you do realize it's okay to rent stuff, too. I mean, there's a lot of movies out there that are just old movies that you can rent for like $2 or $3 online. It's a steal. I mean, look, back in the days of Blockbuster Video, it was $3 or more to rent a video for a weekend. You don't have to leave the house. You can just go rent it online, and it's amazing what you can find. And if you're willing to pay $3-4, you can find almost any movie out there. And I was sitting with my family, and I can't remember what brought it up, but I was referencing a movie, and I referenced the Pink Panther or something. I think it was, I was telling a fart joke. That's okay. I'll put all the cards on the table. I was telling a fart joke, and there's the new Pink Panther, the ones they made with Steve Martin. There's a couple of those. In those movies, I'm proud to say that I'm a connoisseur, or as Larry Fine would say, I'm a common sewer about bathroom humor. But I was talking about the Pink Panther, and my son, who's 17, he was almost 17, and he mentioned the Steve Martin movies, and I go, well, there was a whole set of movies made before that he didn't know, and I also brought up the piece of trivia that the Pink Panther cartoons, they originated because when they did the original Pink Panther movie and they had the opening cartoon at the beginning, that became so popular they made a series of cartoons based on it. So actually the movie came first. But I was talking about how, you know, the first Pink Panther was funny and it was good. It's worth seeing. But Clouseau's not nearly bumbling enough. And then it's Shot in the Dark. Same thing. It's a fun little movie, but Clouseau is not at the level of Clouseau that Peter Sellers made him in the 70s. Then they made this weird little offshoot, Inspector Clouseau, where Alan Arkin played him. But it wasn't until the mid 70s that they brought this back. And I was telling my son about it. I go, you'd love these movies. And so later that night, we rented one and we watched it, and it's a hoot. So we watched, The Return of the Pink Panther, which is the first of the three best Pink Panther, like, slapstick comedies are Return of the Pink Panther, The Pink Panther Strikes Again, and then Revenge of the Pink Panther. So we watched Return, and in this one, bumbling Inspector Jacques Clouseau is brought in to discover who stole the invaluable Pink Panther diamond again.
The Pink Panther, the world's largest diamond, has been stolen again. And there's only one man who can get it back.
I am calling in outside help. The famous French detective who recovered the Pink Panther the last time it was stolen.
Clouseau.
How can an idiot be a policeman? Answer me that!
It's very simple. All he has to do is enlist.
How do you know so much about city ordinances?
What sort of stupid question is that? Are you blind?
Yes.
What's great about this one is you actually don't need to have seen either The Pink Panther or Shot in the Dark. And in some ways, it's not even consistent because Herbert Lom plays Inspector Dreyfus, and he's hilarious at him. He's the head. He's in charge. He's the boss of Clouseau and hates him so much he was trying to kill him. But somehow he's still Inspector. I don't know. It's sort of like the way the mayor in Jaws gets reelected for Jaws 2. But this is when the Pink Panther movies gelled and became the Pink Panther movies. And they are a hoot. I hadn't seen this one in a long time because my favorite was always Revenge of the Pink Panther. But this one is wickedly funny because of the timing and the comic mastery of Peter Sellers. You have Clouseau in his perfect, complete, blithering idiot stage where he thinks he's smart, but he's really not. And everybody else thinks he's smart, but he absolutely is not. And it deals with these scenes. I mean, the plot is relatively thin because these movies don't have a terribly intricate plot because they'll have these elements and moments where, you know, they take their time to have Clouseau bumble around for 10 minutes in a scene. And it's wildly entertaining, but it doesn't necessarily further the plot. But that's the point of the movie. And I have to say, revisiting the Pink Panther movies is an absolute gem. I remember seeing them in the 70s as a kid, and they're just as funny, if not even funnier now. They still hold up. These ones from the 70s certainly still hold up. So I'm going to have to say The Return of the Pink Panther totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Escape from LA, which comes to us via Shout Factory. Now, Shout Factory has been doing a bang-up job getting old movies and old genre films in particular, old either exploitative action movies like Vice Squad or Cobra, or they have like horror movies and science fiction films. They have a bunch of the old Hammer stuff. I know I got the Quatermass films to review from them. I talked about Curse of the Werewolf a couple weeks ago. And Escape from L.A. is their latest in their John Carpenter offerings. You know, I don't know if they have all of the John Carpenter movies, but they got most of them. I mean, all of them, including stuff I've talked about on the show, like Big Trouble in Little China. They got the original Escape from New York, and they've got stuff like Someone to Watch Over Me, and they have Prince of Darkness. The John Carpenter run in the 80s and 90s were really good. Now, there's some that aren't great, like, you know, Village of the Damned is kind of eh. And in general, Escape from L.A. gets a lot of guff, but I'm here to defend it. So let's talk about it really quick. In Escape from L.A., Snake Plissken is brought back once again to save a hostage from the destroyed island of Los Angeles.
Your rules are really beginning to annoy me.
We ran a psycho profile on him using a database of 5 million sociopathic personalities. He hit the bottom of the curve.
Catches on quick, doesn't she?
This town loves a winner.
Let's say we play a little Bangkok rules. Nobody draws until this hits the ground. You ready? Draw.
This is in a lot of ways a remake of Escape from New York. I will say, I've never been a massive Escape from New York fan. I've seen Escape from New York. I've seen it in a theater on 35mm. I've seen it at home on VHS and on DVD or Blu-ray. It's fine. It's okay. I mean, the character Snake Plissken gets old quickly. I know he's an icon, but, you know, he's just the grumbling, you know, he's basically a young, eye-patched Clint Eastwood with long hair. You know, he's grumbling and that's sort of his shtick. But boy, does it work for him. But even though I haven't liked the Escape from New York as much, I kind of liked Escape from L.A. better. I remember seeing it in the theater and liking it back then. I watched it about 10 years ago. We live tweeted it with a group of friends, and I realized it doesn't quite hold up. There's a lot of parts to this that don't quite hold up in terms of special effects. This was in the sort of the sophomoric era of CGI. So there's a lot of CGI that really does not look good. The kind of stuff that you saw in the movie Species or Spawn, which kind of looked cool then, but after really nuanced CGI has come around, you realize was kind of rubbish. So the special effects don't quite hold up, I will admit. But essentially, it's the same kind of story where he's going in as this anarchistic crazy to try and save somebody from this island prison for a corrupt president. And that's essentially the story from Escape from New York. But this one's fun. I mean, it has some crazy elements to it. It's entertaining because I think it moves from crazy thing to crazy thing and it moves a little bit better, and there's more set pieces than you had in Escape from New York. And so this, I have to say, this is one I like a little bit better, but it's silly and it's fun. I enjoyed it quite a bit. So the new Blu-ray has a new 4K scan of the film, and the film looks actually really good. I mean, that's one thing that Shout Factor has really done, is it's brought up the quality of the prints that they've been transferring to the Blu-ray. And they had some new interviews with actors Peter Jason and George Corfus, as well as the visual effects artist David Jones. There's also an interview with Bruce Campbell. It's done over the phone, but, you know, hey, that might be where we're going here with interviews, at least for the next year or so. And then still gallery TV spots and the original theatrical trailer. If you have never seen it, it's worth checking out, and I will defend it as a John Carpenter classic. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Blackout, Invasion Earth, and The Aerialist. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.